Now, a look at the essence of terrorism. It's been around for quite a long time in one guise or another, but seems to have pushed its way to centre stage in recent decades as a means, by killings or kidnappings, rather grotesque means, of making a point of one kind or another, or of simply destabilising a regime, an ideology or a whole society that its perpetrators want to see humbled. The 9/11 attacks gave some perspective to what Noam Chomsky rather cryptically called retail terrorism, the acts committed by individuals and groups not representing a state. The difference between state and non-state terrorism is one that is of particular interest to Professor Richard Jackson, an expert on critical terrorism studies. A New Zealander, he's Professor of International Relations at the University of Aberystwyth in Wales. I asked him, is there an adequate definition of terrorism?
I'm not sure that there's an adequate one. I think that what there is a great deal of competing definitions of terrorism. And there's so many definitions that it's actually become something of a cliche to say that no one actually knows how to define terrorism. And I think that this is part of the problem, is that that there is no sort of universally accepted definition of terrorism, which is why the whole area becomes something of a competition, if you like, between different conceptions of what terrorism is, what it should be. And it sort of feeds into this notion that it's very much a kind of subjective thing, that one person's terrorist is another person's
freedom fighter, yeah.
And that, you know, your terrorism is worse than my terrorism, and so on. I mean, the problem is that the term has so many negative connotations that some people have said it shouldn't actually be used as a kind of a proper academic term. It's really just more of an insult.
You've been involved in some of the reassessment of this, as I understand it, and the establishment of, I think, what you call critical terrorism studies, trying to unpick the rather complicated connections between state terrorism and other forms of terrorism. Has the analysis of terrorism more broadly become the victim of moral judgments? When is it moral judgments, which are overlaid with political judgments, at the core of the difficulty here?
I think you've hit the nail right on the head there. I mean, this is the whole problem of the definition of terrorism, is that, in fact, if you go back to the late 1960s and early 1970s, when scholars were studying terrorism, they actually studied it within the context of insurgency, civil war, and sort of political violence more broadly. And really what began to happen in the early 1970s was that a kind of new field emerged of terrorism studies, which then, particularly in the 1980s, became tied in with Reagan's conflict against the Soviet Union, for example, where it got redefined as a kind of purely immoral kind of violence. So no longer was terrorism simply a strategy of political violence that a whole range of different actors could use, state actors, different kind of insurgent groups, different kind of social movements, protest groups, and so on. But it became a kind of special violence, a violence that was overlaid by a deep moral ambivalence. You know, you could never justify terrorism. And because it took on that moral tenor, it then became part of a big set of conflicts and debates over whether freedom fighters who are fighting against an unjust system, for example, should be called terrorists or not. And should what governments do be called terrorism or not?
Yes, I want to come to that in a moment. But terrorism as a term has a long history. I mean, it was coined, well, as far as I know, certainly after the Second World War, maybe before it, in Spain and places like that, in Israel after the Second World War. Do you have any idea when the term was first used and what the context was for that?
Well, actually, the term terrorism and the term terror goes back to the French Revolution.
Mm,
And it was actually a term that was used initially to describe the kind of violence by the state against the state's enemies, okay? So it was a term used to describe the way in which the Jacobin government tried to eradicate all enemies of the French Revolution. So in actual fact, the first sort of meaning of the term was actually the use of violence by governments to intimidate their enemies and to terrify a population into going along with their ideas. And what we find is that that meaning sort of changed in the late 1800s, particularly when the anarchist movement began to try and assassinate leaders and try and promote a revolution through the use of dynamite attacks and assassinations on public figures. And then what we see is around World War II, particularly with the Nazis, and then particularly also with Stalin's Great Terror, a return to this idea that terrorism is really about governments using extreme violence against vast numbers of people as a means of kind of rule, as a way of kind of governing a society. And then, as you say, after World War II, it gradually moves back again to come to mean the violence that small groups of, dissidents and opposition to the state use as a way of advancing their cause. And really, from 1968 onwards, when we have the beginning of the PLO and the Palestinian international hijackings and so on, this is really what we call the era of modern terrorism. And from that period on, in fact, terrorism becomes almost exclusively reserved for talking about different types of non-state groups, guerrilla movements and so on.
So in that context, the state is now, or at least presently, getting off rather lightly. So state terrorism, which and it's interesting that the state began it all, if the terror is the beginning of it in France, the state is now getting off rather lightly, and there is a blurring of the distinction between state and non-state terrorism that has occurred. What is the logical outcome of that? Are we going to see another sort of oscillation where attention will shift back to state terrorism in a broader sense?
I'm not really sure about that, because my personal sort of perception of it is that the idea of what terrorism is as a kind of political violence directed against civilians, usually by suicide bombers or people like Anders Breivik in Oslo, the perception of terrorism has now become so widely spread in our culture, and it also it's become so widely spread within legislation. I mean, as you know, every government in the world was directed by the UN after 9/11 to review its anti-terrorism legislation. And so every country in the world now has laws against terrorism. So what you've got is a global legal regime as well as a global culture that sees terrorism primarily as something that non-state actors do. And in that context, what states do, and whether that should be called terrorism if it's the same thing, has sort of slipped out of view. Now, that's really where critical terrorism studies comes in, because one of the things that we have tried to do is to question this division and to question this popular and academic and political and legal understanding of what terrorism is. We've pointed out that if state agents put a bomb on a plane, as happened at Lockerbie, if state agents put a bomb in a train station, as happened in Bologna in the 80s, then that should be called terrorism equally as if al-Qaeda does it. I mean, the problem with that is that that challenges governments to watch their behavior and to avoid kinds of violence and kinds of actions that they might otherwise prefer to be free to do. And so part of critical terrorism studies is to point out the consequence of this kind of you might call it a hypocrisy, whereby a government says, we define terrorism in such a way and everyone else can be condemned for terrorism.
Yes.
If we do the same things, we can't be condemned for terrorism.
I gather that attempts to examine the motivations of terrorists can get you into some hot water. You then become labelled as an apologist. How pervasive is that?
Well, I think it is very pervasive, and I think it comes back to your original question, your original point, which is that because terrorism is viewed in these very stark moral terms, because it's viewed as a very particular kind of modern evil, then it makes it very difficult whenever scholars try and understand at a deeper level what drives people to undertake these kinds of action. When you come out and say, you know, it's fine to condemn terrorism as morally evil, and it is morally evil, you know, that kind of violence has many innocent victims and it's wrong, but if we really want to deal with it, if we really want to prevent it from occurring again, we have to understand a little more and at a much deeper level why people would choose to do that. What are the conditions under which that choice becomes attractive to them? How do we understand their motivations and the reasons for adopting particular types of violent strategies? Then people think that what you're doing is apologizing for terrorism, excusing it, you know, giving it some kind of justification.
Have you been
when
accused
in fact,
of this?
The opposite is the case. Well, yeah. What we're trying to do in reality is prevent it from happening again by, first of all, diagnosing it more correctly.
Yeah. Have you been accused of this kind of rationalization?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah?
And in fact, at the conference we were having today, we were talking exactly about this issue, that within the sort of terrorism field, there's a kind of rule that you have to morally condemn terrorists before you're allowed to sort of speak about it, as it were. That's part of your credentials, that you say terrorism is this great evil and so on, and then you're allowed to speak about it. And critical terrorism studies scholars, including myself, have been criticized on a lot of occasions for not spending enough time suggesting how wrong and evil terrorism is and how much of a threat to Western civilization it is. But in fact, that's not really what we see our purpose of being. I mean, part of what we want to do is to question these kinds of categories. I mean, from the perspective of many of the terrorists, you know, going to Iraq and killing between 120,000 and maybe a million people for bogus reasons of weapons of mass destruction or connections with 9/11 or whatever, to them, that's a moral evil that's equally as great as the moral evil of 9/11, for example.
Yes.
And so we think that taking that viewpoint seriously is a responsible thing to do. But of course, saying that kind of thing can get you into trouble.
Are there difficulties in accessing funding for research? I think some people have said that there are some limits, particularly so. Look, a lot of the funding goes to private think tanks, government security agencies, or is conducted by them or for them, so that there is a certain crowding of the landscape. How much of a problem is that?
I think that at one level that is a problem, although I have to preface this by saying that I don't have any systematic data or any, large-scale evidence to show that this is true. I just happen to know anecdotally the difficulties that critical scholars have faced in trying to get funding, and also simply the observation that if the government puts forward a pot of money and says we want research bids on this about how Islamic extremism causes terrorism and it's got nothing to do with Western foreign policy or how great a threat terrorism is, in order to get that money and in order to continue to receive further money, you often have to tailor your research to try and say, a bit, at least, what the funding provider is actually looking for.
Yeah.
And if you were to come out and say, well, in fact, following on from other research, which wasn't funded, but which is quite rigorous, it shows that there's a direct correlation between American foreign military intervention and anti-American terrorism. In other words, you know, you could reduce terrorism by reducing military intervention overseas, you're unlikely to be funded again.
Yes, the high price of academic freedom. I'm talking to Richard Jackson. Let's look at 9/11. When it occurred, wasn't it natural for Americans to demand an aggressive response to such a appallingly aggressive act, and to interpret it as an act of war? And it seemed perfectly, at the time, it seemed almost natural that that would happen. But how natural was it?
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean by natural. If you mean that, was it understandable within the context of American culture, I think that it was perfectly understandable. I mean, America had reacted to terrorism in the past in very similar ways. So that after the 1998 embassy bombings in East Africa, for example, Clinton bombed Sudan and he bombed Afghanistan. After the disco bombing in Berlin in the 1980s, Reagan bombed Gaddafi, actually,
yeah.
Who he felt was responsible. So there's always been this kind of militarized response to terrorism. Particularly in the American context, which it is very much a militarized culture.
Yeah.
The military plays a very big role in that culture. They spend the most money of everyone in the world on the military. And, you know, all their film and television shows are about heroic military people. It's a very militarized culture.
And that's why Al-Qaeda chose it. Or at least partly why they chose it. You say...
Well, in many ways, the 9/11 was... A lot of people see it as a bolt from the blue, but in fact it was the culmination of a series of attacks and counterattacks going back to at least 1991.
You say
so,
that...
you know, it was part of a cycle of violence between Al-Qaeda and America where they would bomb each other every few years.
You say that language... used to justify the war on terror, and that expression itself tells us something, was deliberately and very carefully chosen. And I suppose the question is, was this to enable them, the Americans and others, British and others, even the Australians, to pursue very specific objectives in relation to that that conflict? Call it a war, it's difficult.
Well, that's the conclusion of my research, and I looked at literally hundreds of speeches and also did a lot of research going back as well to Reagan's first war on terrorism. I mean, a lot of people don't realize this, but, you know, this is probably the second, maybe even the third war on terrorism. I think Clinton used the term war against terrorism a couple of times, but definitely Reagan used the term war on terrorism quite a lot, and enacted a whole series of measures, and so did Bush. Obviously, they really, both of them, really crafted the kind of justificatory language in very specific ways, and you can trace how that language is designed to appeal to the American public. It's also designed to sort of legitimize what they decide to do in the eyes of the world. So, yes, I would agree that if you look closely at the language and if you analyze it, this idea, for example, that it is a war on terrorism means that you have to use military means. You can't fight a war without an army, without a military.
Yeah.
So that's a very deliberate kind of rhetorical phrase that allows the U.S. government and its allies to then say, Afghanistan invasion... it's the first phase of the war on terrorism. And then they came out and said that Iraq was the second phase of the war on terrorism. And in many ways, you know, the drone attacks in Pakistan and the military involvement in Yemen and other places is also part of the war on terrorism.
How much similarity was there in the speeches that that Bush, Tony Blair, even John Howard would give? Was there a sort of concerted use of terminology here? And do you think that this wasn't just accidental? I mean, these were people singing from a very well-organized, similar song sheet?
I think that is definitely the case. I did some research on this as well, looking at the speeches of all those three leaders. And one of the interesting things that I found, along with a colleague of mine, Matt McDonald, at Queensland University, that they all three of them have very, very similar notions of, first of all, what the nature of the threat facing the world is in terms of Islamist terrorism and the kind of danger that it poses to our society. And on the basis of that, the necessity of such a large-scale response to that. But they also all use similar language about kind of the evil of terrorism. It's a modern evil. And about the necessity of using extraordinary means, trying to come together to coordinate. But then if you look more closely, what you find is that, and this is where the deliberate nature of it comes in, that they use a kind of language that's very specific to their culture. And you know, I mean, you recognize that if Tony Blair had talked about we want to catch bin Laden, he wanted dead or alive, that kind of language wouldn't resonate in the United Kingdom. Hmm. But it does resonate in America. Yes. Similarly, when Howard came out and said, we stand shoulder to shoulder with America's war on terrorism, and this is what mateship is all about.
Yes.
He's appealing to an Australian notion of mateship that's very deep in the culture. That wouldn't really mean anything if Blair or Bush used it. So what they're doing is they're framing their appeals, the language that they use, in very specific cultural terms to appeal to the public that they want to go along with them.
Yeah. You maintain that there was a real opportunity immediately after 9/11 to strike a new order, another new international order. But that opportunity was passed up, it was missed. Isn't that slightly optimistic, given the sort of biblical dimensions of 9/11 and the awful consequences of it in the minds of most, particularly Americans? What sort of opportunity was missed?
I think that if you look at the response of the Norwegian government to the most recent terrorist attack in Oslo, what you see there is an incredibly different response to what is a terrible and horrific act of terrorism.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of those people killed there were children. I mean, children were massacred. This is a horrible, horrible act. If the Norwegian government had come out and said, this was an act of war against our society, we're going to increase military spending, we're going to increase, you know, the security services powers, we're going to bring in a whole range of new laws restricting gun ownership and people's involvement on the internet with radical groups and so on, no one would have been surprised, right? I mean, this was a horrible act. But they showed that in the face of terrible, horrific acts of violence, it is possible to respond with genuine maturity, with genuine desire to maintain the values of their society, to promote reconciliation, to try and deal progressively and positively with the challenge of trying to prevent people from using violence, rather than reacting in a very knee-jerk fashion and thinking all we have to do is respond with even greater violence than what they use. Now, I mean, maybe I am a bit optimistic, but I felt, following 9/11, and I remember it very, very distinctly. I watched it all day that day, and it changed my life in many ways. It put me on the path of research that I've since embraced. I felt, along with everyone else around the world, such a degree of sympathy with America. And I cannot help but feel that if at that moment America had said, right, we're going to stop messing about now and we're going to sort out the Middle East conflict. And we're going to stop messing about and letting anyone produce weapons and sell them to everyone. We're going to properly regulate this. Yeah. And we're going to get to the heart of why people use violence in their conflicts. I think everyone would have followed along.
Yeah. But why has President Obama, who is much more given to this bigger picture, simply continued the narrative, used the same kinds of expressions? There is a continuity about American policy, which everybody, most people who thought there may be a change, are rather surprised by. What do you put that down to?
Well, this is very interesting, and you've obviously done your research very well. I've recently written a paper on this as well, and my research suggests that a large part of the answer to this question is the way in which the counterterrorism industry has become kind of institutionalized. We now have in America the Department of Homeland Security, which has 180,000 employees. We have a private security sector of 800,000 people who are involved through contracting in some way or direct involvement in counterterrorism in the United States. We're talking about budgets here of 50 to 100 billion plus being spent. That's a lot of careers in counterterrorism. The military is involved in at least three or four major operations in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, and the Horn of Africa. I mean, we're talking about a huge, big machine here. And I think the point is, once that machine is in place and up and running, it is extremely difficult for one person, even the President of the United States, to kind of change course. Now, interestingly, he has tried to make a few small changes. He's kind of banned this idea of war on terrorism, and he doesn't use that phrase anymore. But you're right in saying most of the policies have continued, and a lot of the rhetoric has continued. And like I said, I think that this is because it's now so deeply embedded into the American political and economic system and into the global system. You know, think of all the laws. Think of all the international cooperation going on between NATO and the United Nations and the EU. I mean, there's a whole web of relationships and practices and organizations now that are all invested in countering global terrorism. It's very hard to change all that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, it'll take, like the Cold War, it's kind of part of our cultural and political landscape now. It's going to take many years for it to be wound out, unless there's a kind of radical event which diverts our attention into something else.
Well, the natural conclusion to all of that is that on this 10th anniversary of 9/11, there is going to be no change. I mean, we saw the joy of those in Times Square, New York, at the death, the assassination, the murder, call it what you like, of bin Laden. That tells, and it's quite recent, that tells us an awful lot about the attitudes. And from everything you've just said, there will be no change. So the 10th anniversary is not going to yield up some kind of soul-searching and change of mind.
Well, that is certainly a valid conclusion, and that is definitely one way to look at it. And I probably, in my heart of hearts, I am fairly pessimistic that that anything can change, or that radical change will occur just because we're having this anniversary and we're trying to reflect on the last 10 years. But what I would say is that, I mean, I think that as human beings, we aren't just subject to history impacting upon us, but that we can help to make a difference. And I think that when you have groups of radical scholars like the group that I'm involved in, the Critical Terrorism Studies Network, who are out there in the media and also behind the scenes and in academia, teaching hundreds, thousands of students, getting involved in conferences and debates, writing editorials and so on, that, you know, we can ask questions, we can challenge dominant points of view, we can try and get people to reflect. And I think that it's through this kind of struggle that maybe you're right, maybe nothing's going to change this year, might not change next year or the year after, but maybe in 5 or 10 years' time, you know, through struggles like this, through writing new books and publishing new research, and I personally, I think that people are beginning to realize how ineffective, how damaging, and how pointless the war on terror has been, and what a colossal waste of money and lives and resources. You know, together, these kind of things give us hope that the war on terror and all those destructive policies will gradually come grinding to a halt.
That was Richard Jackson, Professor of International Relations at the University of Aberystwyth in Wales. And this week he actually gives a keynote address at an international conference on terrorism at the University of Glasgow on 9/11. That's 10 years on. In February, he takes up the role of Deputy Director of the National Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Otago.